Hey, it's you, man, from KC95 here. Good evening and welcome to Toasted Tavern. Your host, Scott Tobin, and the man called Wags are ready to bring you the night in sports. So pull up a stool, grab a drink, and let's get toasted.
And good evening once again. Third night in a row that the Toasted Tavern has been open. I think we got our liquor license back. That's kind of why things are back off and rolling here on the Tavern. I am Wags, joined alongside by Scott Tobin. And we are both stitching our hearts back together from today's Cardinals-Mets game. But we're stitching it together with some minor league string and in hopes that the Blues don't break our hearts again tonight. But before we get to that, Scott, man, how you doing? Did you stay safe out there in this wild weather that we had here in St. Louis today?
Yeah, I stayed relatively safe. You know, the tornado sirens went off a couple of times, and there were some supposed tornado funnels flying around the area, but other than that, it did okay. The skies got crazy, I will give you that. There were some pretty cool colors, green and black and gray and all kinds of stuff going on out there today. But, I was able to stay safe, and hopefully everybody out there was as well.
Yeah, that's the biggest part, is just that everybody was safe today, even if there was any sort of tornado touchdowns or anything like that, that everybody was able to stay safe. That's the biggest piece of that. And now you get a chance to watch the Blues play at Colorado again tonight. Hopefully it's a better outcome than Tuesday night. Although the game was close, it wasn't the right kind of game that you wanted to see the Blues play. But we'll talk about that as we get closer to previewing that game, as we get closer and closer to puck drop, which is around 8:30 to 9 o'clock, as it is every nationally televised game. You just never know when it's going to start. But we got to start with the Cardinals, because they took on the Mets today in the finale of their four-game series. A chance to win the season series against the Mets, or at least tie the season series against the Mets. They've just not been all that great against the team from New York this year. It was a back and forth affair. I mean, the Cardinals were down multiple times. They fell back 2-0. They fell behind 5-3. Essentially, Paul Goldschmidt just put the team on his back and multiple times found ways to tie this game back up for the Cardinals. And then you get into the 10th inning, and first off, the runner on second being back as part of, you know, baseball, come on, just stop it. But, it didn't matter in a sense in this game, because Giovanni Gallegos came in and gave up a home run to the strongest man in baseball, Pete Alonso, and the Mets end up taking this one 7-6. So, Scott, I know you got a chance to watch pieces of it. I got a chance to watch pieces of it, too. What was your takeaway from today's game with the Cardinals and Mets, just kind of in a nutshell?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, like, this whole series between the Cardinals and Mets, kind of back and forth, pretty competitive games. I think they're two pretty even teams. You know, the Cardinals bullpen unfortunately came up short again today, which has happened a couple of times in this series against the Mets. That's the second time Gallegos has blown a game against the Mets in the ninth inning or extra innings this year. And then, you know, we had the mess yesterday where the Cardinals got close, and then TJ McFarland, who we talked about last night, kind of imploded in that bottom of the eighth, and the game got out of hand. But, you know, I mean, there were some positive things to look at when you look at this team. Dylan Carlson starting to heat up. You know, we saw Albert Pujols take some really good at-bats against some right-handed pitching. You know, he had a couple of hits, a couple of RBIs last night. He hit a couple of balls hard tonight. He hit a ball today in the eighth inning that I think everybody at the ballpark, and especially the announcers and Albert, thought were gone. You know, you and I talked about that. McLaughlin and Edmonds both thought it was gone. The camera guy thought it was gone. Albert thought it was gone. And the left fielder caught it like a foot in front of the wall. I mean, the camera guy was literally painting like the second deck. Like, that's how far they thought that ball was going to go. And the left fielder caught it right in front of the fence. But it was cold and windy in New York, and those things happen. But again, Albert did take really good at bats. We saw good things from Dylan Carlson. Paul Goldschmidt's just absolutely on fire. I mean, the guy's got a 12-game hitting streak. He's driven home 15 RBIs during that stretch. He's up to 27 RBIs now. Him and, you know, Nolan's first. Well, I guess Pete Alonso jumped ahead of Nolan today. So I guess Nolan's second, and Goldschmidt's like fourth in the RBIs now. But you look at those two guys, we've played 38 games, Wags. The two of them now have 14 home runs, and they have 58 RBIs in 38 games. I mean, they're both on a pace for about 125, 130 RBIs this year. So, you know, that's pretty exciting to look forward to. like we said, Dylan Carlson starting to heat up. You know, Yepes keeps hitting. You know, the bad thing, the Cardinals are a little banged up right now. We heard today that Tyler O'Neill's going on the disabled list. Edmundo Sosa's banged up. Tommy Edman's banged up. So those are some question marks that you've got. But some things that the Cardinal fans have been begging for, screaming for, begging, pounding on Mo's desk, pounding on Mo's door, screaming for what, weeks now? Cardinal fans, guess what? You're getting Nolan Gorman. And not only are you getting Nolan Gorman tomorrow, on Saturday, you're getting your top pitching prospect and Nolan Gorman's lifelong best friend, Matthew Liberatore, is making his major league debut on Saturday. So how cool is it that the two kids that grew up together ended up, you know, Liberatore gets traded to the Cardinal organization. Now they're making their major league debuts on the same weekend in Pittsburgh. I mean, you couldn't write a story better than that for two guys that have been friends since they were 8 or 9 years old.
You really can. I mean, both guys, like you said, have been friends since about five. They both decided to go into baseball. They're both successful at baseball. They get drafted. They're both top 40 as far as, you know, personnel in the minor leagues. And they go to the same – they end up in the same team. Now they're getting called up, and they're going to play together and make their debuts essentially together. It's insane. I mean, it is what the Cardinals fans have been clamoring for. We'll see if it actually plays out. We'll talk about that here in just a second. But I just want to backtrack a bit to the game. You were talking about, you know, RBIs and all that. You know, Pete Alonso, yes, definitely went ahead of Nolan Arenado this week. He's sitting tops in the NL at 36. Nolan second in the NL with 31. Goldschmidt sitting at tied for sixth with 27 in the National League with Bryce Harper, Trey Turner, and Jazz Chisholm. As well, you've got CJ Cron, Roddy Tellez, and Justin Turner in between those guys. But you just, like you said, these guys are going to, you know, combine for well over 100 RBIs, at least 30 home runs apiece this year. I mean, it's exactly what you need for the middle of the lineup, but you need more of the lineup around it to be successful. Juan Yepes has been hitting. He went 3 for 5 today, hit a home run. Like you said, Dylan Carlson is starting to heat up right now, and that's a big thing. Harrison Bader's speed was crucial in that ninth inning, so seeing him get on base and being able to, you know, make some hay out on the base pass is a big thing. You talked about being banged up. Andrew Kisner is also a bit under evaluation. Ivan Herrera, a third call up today. He's going over onto the taxi squad just in case something happens with Andrew Kisner. So, you know, you're getting some positives. You're getting some negatives. The fact that O'Neill is going on the IL with a shoulder impingement, is it really an injury or is it really a mind reset for him? I mean, I had to think that there is some piece of injury part to this, but I don't think it's fully why he's going on the IL. And you know, like you said, Pujols is kind of doing what he needs to do right now. We don't know how long that's going to last. I don't think we can expect it to last all season. But you still have guys like Dickerson that isn't doing a whole lot. And you talk about Edman being banged up. That's another piece. You know, he came into the game last night when Sosa injured his ankle. But now that he's going over to shortstop, that's going to be a little bit more wear and tear on him. So how often do they use him? And if he's not in that spot, who is at shortstop? Do you put a Brendan Donovan over there? And if that's the case, can he continue to be successful in the role that he's been put in as well? So, yes, you've got a lot of positives, you got some negatives, you still got a whole lot of questions because we haven't even, outside of touching on it, we haven't really even talked about the bullpen and what's going on there or what Jordan Hicks is doing or the fact that Dakota Hudson only went 4 2/3 today. So, I mean, there's still 7 or 8 different questions that are going around that they're not going to be fixed by Gorman and Liberatore being called up. It's great that these guys are going to be up here, but there's still a bunch of question marks we have around this team.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a ton of questions. And I have a big one for you. You just said now that Tommy Edman's moving over to shortstop. I'm not so sure that's the case. I think Brendan Donovan's your shortstop. You know, for one thing, Edman's a little hobbled, but we've seen no indication from the Cardinals that they had any interest in moving Tommy Edman to shortstop. You know, you would think that if that was the plan, they would have been doing that all along. I kind of think Brendan Donovan's your shortstop. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how they make this work, because I think you're going to see a lot of Juan Yepes in left field, you know, until you get Tyler O'Neill back. I think you see a lot of Yepes at left. I think you're going to see a lot of Albert Pujols in the lineup as your DH. And I think you're going to see a lot of Nolan Gorman at second base. So, you know, does Tommy Edman play some outfield, which is possible, you know, and then, you know, some days Albert doesn't play and you move it around that way. But I think Tommy Edman might, in some ways, be kind of the odd man out for the next couple of weeks.
Well, according to Derek Gould, Ali Marmol said today that Edman will slide over to shortstop for the time being to continue to get starts. Once again, it's just what he said. Could be a couple of starts, and then you go, okay, yeah, he really can't do this, and then it moves into that plan of maybe playing him in the outfield or what have you. But at this point right now, about 2 hours ago from Derek Gould, Tommy Edman will begin getting starts at shortstop to make room, Marmol says. So at least right now, it's expected that Tommy Edman will move over to the shortstop position initially. If that holds, we'll see. Like you said, he is a bit hobbled. He got hit by a pitch the other night against the Mets. He ended up was sitting out yesterday's game and wouldn't have played unless Edmundo Sosa didn't get hurt in that game. So it's going to be interesting to see how long he does last, if he can succeed there. And then if that's not the case, what's the plan then? It probably will go to Donovan. And then do you play Edmund or do you not play him and maybe use him off the bench?
Well, how do you take Brendan Donovan out of the lineup right now? Because he's been your leadoff hitter for the last week, and he's been doing everything you could ask for. He's stealing bases. He's drawing walks. He's been on fire at the plate. He's hitting better than Tommy Edman is right now. So, again, do you, just for the sake of playing Tommy Edman, do you take a guy who's kind of lit a little spark under this team since he's come up and had some big clutch hits as well? Do you sit him on the bench to try to see if you can get Nolan Gorman in there? I mean, like I said, there's just a lot of questions as to how you make this lineup even work every day.
Yeah, very, very true. But the fact that you have pieces that you can move around at least shows you that, there's a little bit of depth there that the Cardinals haven't really had the last couple of years. Despite the fact that everybody's preached that this team has had depth, it feels like they really haven't. Well, now you've got options that if they are successful, now you have a good problem to have on hand. And well, let's dive in a little bit deeper into what Gorman and Libertor bring to this Cardinals team. And it's hard to say what they're going to do here at the major league level because the minors are so different from the major league level for sure. But just taking a look at what Nolan Gorman's done this year, everybody knows about the 15 home runs down there in the minors at Memphis. He has the most home runs by minor leaguers in the country. And the next guy is somebody down at Springfield. So the Cardinals have a lot of hot hitting power bats in their minor league organization. He's actually upped his batting average to .308. He's got a .308, .367, .677 slash right now, which just a couple days ago we were seeing it was kind of in the mid 200s. So we're starting to see maybe a little bit better of a batter's eye from him as the season's gone on. He struck out 50 times in 133 at bats. So even that is kind of that ratio has kind of come down just a little bit as well. When we looked at it the other day, he was closer to striking out in half of his at-bats. Well, now that's definitely changed a little bit. And as you said, he'll start tomorrow. He'll be at second base as the Cardinals take on Pittsburgh. And honestly, this was probably the right time to do this because you're going up against a Pirates team that isn't all that great. So you can kind of build a little confidence for not just Gorman, but also Libertor, because they can probably be successful against a Pirates team. It's not like you're going to be going up against the Mets or the Giants or the Blue Jays or the Brewers or anything like that, where you could really shatter somebody's confidence early on. So this may have been just a target for the Cardinals as well, that if we were going to bring these guys up, this would have been one of the areas where they go, okay, we feel comfortable doing it here because it's against lesser competition versus this past week or later on next week. Not to say that they were targeting this exact spot, but if they were looking at the schedule, it's okay, this might be an area where we could do it. This might be an area where we could do it. It's the perfect time for it in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, this series is good. Then you look the next 9 games after this, I'm not sure, because then you've got Toronto, Milwaukee, and San Diego coming. So that kind of scares you a little bit. But you're right. Pittsburgh is a good place to do it, and it should be a good ballpark for Gorman to hit in. It's a short porch to right field in Pittsburgh. They do have the 20-foot high wall, in honor of Clemente in right field. But Gorman should be able to hit some balls off of that wall anyway if he's able to pull the ball. Pittsburgh's pitching is not great, so hopefully he'll get some advances, like you said, build a little confidence before you run into Toronto and Milwaukee next week. And the same thing for Matthew Libertor to make his first start against the Pirates team. That, although, we talk about Pittsburgh not being good, they're also not that bad. They're only a couple of – last time I looked, they were only a couple of games under .500. So, I mean, they're not the best team, but they're not awful either. It's not like they're playing the Reds.
I mean, they did get no hit by the Reds, but still won. So, right. I mean, that game was absolutely freaking nuts.
Yes, it was. And that could only happen to Cincinnati right now, the way that team is playing ball.
Well, it could only happen to Cincinnati, but the fact that it happened to be against the Pirates, like a team that also would be in the boat that the Reds were in years past, like it wasn't like it was against the Padres or the Brewers. It was against the Pirates. So like a team that has felt that pain inflicted that same sort of pain on the Reds. It was kind of bittersweet in my mind.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure both of those teams felt that as well.
I'm sure they did. So Gorman, have you gotten a chance to see him much play down at Memphis? I mean, I know you've obviously seen the Cardinals working down at Busch, but have you gotten a chance to see what he's been doing down there? Can you see if maybe his swing or his style will translate to the major league level?
I mean, I've not seen a lot. I've seen a little bit. You know, he's got a kind of short, compact swing. You know, I mean, again, it's just going to come down to, you can say, yeah, he's got that short swing that it should translate. It's just going to come down to how quickly he can adjust to the off-speed pitches and breaking balls at the major league level, because that's what he was struggling with at AAA. So, you know, major league pitchers are going to see that. He's going to be lucky if he sees any fastballs for a while when he gets up here. You know, it's going to be a steady dose of off-speed, and how quickly he adjusts to that is going to tell you, you know, what you need to know, because he can hit the fastball. It's just going to be that adjustment.
So, and if that's the case, then do you put him maybe in between Goldschmidt and Arenado? Do you put him lower in the lineup? But if that's the case, there's no real protection around him. I mean, where's the best place for Gorman right off the bat in this lineup? Because, you know, if he's not going to see the fastballs, like you said, if you put him in the bottom part of the lineup. But do you also risk putting him in the middle of that lineup with the protection and maybe he struggles?
You know, as hot as, you know, that might not be a bad idea. As hot as Goldie is, and Arenado seems to be heating up again after a little bit of a slump. So, you know, and he is a lefty. So you split the two righties up, you stick him in that spot. You know, that would be the best place for him to get good pitches. You know, be kind of like what the Cardinals did with Chris Duncan when he first came up, you know, in 2005 and 6. You know, they stuck him right in front of Albert and said, okay, go get him, big boy, as Mike Shannon would say. And, you know, he got fastballs that way. And so that may be the best thing to do, is to stick him in that spot. Because like you said, if you stick him seventh or eighth, he's going to see a steady dose of off speed, and that's going to be pretty much it. So, yeah, that would probably be the best place to put him. Maybe you slide him into that two spot. Or, I'm sorry, slide him into the three spot. You know, have Goldie hit second, have Arenado hit fourth. And see if you can make it work for like that, you know, at least for the weekend. See if he gets going a little bit, and you can build his confidence, and then if he gets really hot, maybe you move him down a little bit if you want to, or wherever you think you need him in the lineup. But yeah, I think that's probably the best place to get him really good pitches and try to get him feeling comfortable and get him acclimated as quickly as possible would be to stick him between those two guys.
Oh, we'll see what Marmol does in that instance, game against the Pirates tomorrow night. And then, like you said earlier, Matthew Liberatore will get the start on Saturday against the Pirates. He's 3-3 with a 3.83 ERA. 46 strikeouts in 40 innings pitched this year. He's been a little bit up and down so far this year. He had a couple games at the end of April that he didn't allow a run, and then he gave up 6 runs 2 starts ago, but then he came back and only gave up 1 run in his previous start. So kind of up and down, a left-handed pitcher, something outside of Steven Matz now that the Cardinals haven't really had a whole lot of left-handers in their starting rotation. But what do we expect out of Liberatore this year? He's not the only pitcher down there that's been having success down at Memphis. So I guess the question is, you know, what does he bring to this team, and why was it him versus a guy like Oviedo or Zach Thompson?
Because, I mean, he is your top pitching prospect. He's the guy that's supposed to be the future ace of this staff. You know, he's the guy that is supposed to slide in right behind Jack Flaherty, or if Flaherty leaves, take that spot at some point in the next couple of years. You know, he is that, you know, he's the top left-handed pitching prospect in the minor leagues. He's been highly touted for a few years now. And, you know, he's got the stuff to do it. You know, he's got a really good curveball. He's got a good changeup. His fastball's in the mid-90s. I mean, he's not throwing 98 or 99, but he's going to consistently hit 94, 95 with his fastball. His curveball is really good. His change isn't bad. And, you know, again, it's just going to be the maturation process. You know, Cardinal fans can't, and we pushed this over and over and over when Dylan Carlson came up here. Don't expect these guys to come up here this weekend and all of a sudden be superstars. Because you got to realize they're both 21 years old. You know, or they may have, Libertor may have just turned 22. They're both really young. You know, they've not had a whole lot of minor league experience above A-ball, basically. So, you know, it's going to take a little while. And, you know, hopefully they come up here. Hopefully they're successful. But, you know, it could be a case where they come up here, struggle, and you have to send them back down for a little while. We saw Dylan Carlson do that. We've seen lots of players do that are really talented. It just takes a while. So, you know, you hope they come up here and they adjust quickly and they're successful from the get-go. But you've got to kind of temper your expectations when these young kids come up here the first time. You know, hopefully it goes really well, but it's just kind of a guessing game at this point as to how quickly they're going to adjust.
Oh, it totally is. And like we said before, the translation from minor league to major league is definitely a huge jump. And you're going to basically be going up against the best of the best every single game that you go out there, regardless of a guy's record or anything like that. It's the best of the best. So you have to temper the expectations. And even if they come out and blow up in their first outing or their first start, you know, don't get too high on it because things can come crashing down very, very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, so, you know, just go into it and say, okay, we're going to get our first look at these guys. They're the future of this team, which they are. You know, hopefully it's very bright and it kicks in right away. But if not, you just have to kind of take your time with it and be patient. And I know that's something that Cardinal fans are not real fond of hearing or wanting to do. But, you know, let's just give these kids some time to figure it out. And like you said, Pittsburgh is probably one of those series that is the best opportunity for them to do that and not have high pressure, because there's not going to be a ton of people in Pittsburgh probably. There may be more Cardinal fans there than there are Pirate fans, especially since fans know now that these guys are making their debuts. And I mean, let's be honest, it's not that long of a trip to jump in your car and drive from St. Louis to Pittsburgh for a weekend, honestly. Or people that live in Ohio or whatever that are Cardinal fans all along the route, you may see a ton of Cardinal fans there tomorrow night, Saturday, and Sunday to cheer these guys on.
Thank you, KMOX, for being able to provide Cardinals fans across the Midwest and giving them an opportunity to see these guys in action. Another note in baseball, and one that kind of sucks for the Mets in a sense, because you know they're already without one of their star pitchers. Max Scherzer lost the game last night, and today he was put on the injured list, potentially out 6 to 8 weeks. I mean, it doesn't sound like that long in a Major League Baseball season, but you're talking, what, 5-6 starts for him that he may miss, and he may not be back after 6 to 8 weeks. That's another blow for this Mets team that has aspirations of winning a division and fighting for a championship. And you know, we can talk about the ill will we have towards the Mets and, you know, how much we hate them and all that stuff. But it is difficult to see a team go through, once again, pitchers that just continuously get injured. The Cardinals feel that. You know, you've got Jack Flaherty that is injured. You've got Alex Reyes that is injured. You've dealt with pitching injuries the last couple of years. So to see another team lose some of their aces due to injury, you got to feel for them just a little bit. And especially since Max is a local guy, you feel sorry and you feel bad for him, then he's going to miss some time.
Yeah, you really do. And like you said, 6 to 8 weeks doesn't sound that long, but you think about it, it's the middle of May. He misses 8 weeks. We're talking after the All-Star break, before you're back. You know, it's going to hurt the Mets, especially when they don't know exactly when they're going to get Jacob DeGrom back. The thing working in their favor is the National League East is not nearly as good as we thought it was going to be. You know, the Phillies are maddeningly, I'll get that word out eventually, maddeningly inconsistent. The Braves have not looked like the Braves team that won a World Series last year. I mean, the best team in the East other than the Mets right now have been the Marlins for the most part with their pitching. I mean, they've just been more consistent than the rest of those teams. And, you know, then you've got the Nationals, who I don't know if you saw the report that came out a couple of days ago, but they're at least contemplating the possibility of trading Juan Soto at the trade deadline. So, you know, that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But the Mets might be able to withstand this for a while because they still have some decent pitching in that rotation. Their bullpen's pretty good. Their lineup is solid.
Yeah.
And they've got a good lead. So they may be able to weather the storm until you get DeGrom or Scherzer back. And, you know, one thing we know about Max is he's super competitive and super intense. And if there's anybody who's going to get back in 6 weeks or less, it'll be Max Scherzer.
So speaking of Juan Soto and the potential that the Washington Nationals may end up trading him sometime here before the All-Star break or even the trade deadline, now, obviously Cardinals fans are always looking to get the next big thing, the next big name, all of that stuff. And, you know, everybody's throwing out trade proposals and saying no one on this team is safe. They'll trade anybody for a Juan Soto. You know, there's people today saying, oh, congratulations to Nolan Gorman and Matthew Liberatore for coming up for your auditions for Washington because you're going to be part of the Juan Soto deal. The Cardinals are not going to be in on Juan Soto. They don't want to give up these high prospects. They want to continue to have cost-controlled guys and everything like that. But hypothetically, what would it take for the Cardinals to pull off a move to bring in a guy like Juan Soto? Obviously, we don't know what the Nationals are looking for, but what would you see being the case for a Juan Soto trade?
You know what the Nationals are going to ask for? Matthew Liberatore, Nolan Gorman, Jordan Walker, Ivan Herrera, and something else. They're going to ask for your top four or five prospects and more. You're not doing that. You know, you're going to have Soto for 2 years of control, and he'll only be 25 at that point. But he turned down a $350 million offer from the Nationals this year. Scott Boras is his agent. He's going to go for $450 or $500 million in a couple of years. That's what his asking price is going to be. Somebody's going to make that trade, and they're going to regret it because they're literally going to have to give up their whole farm system. And, again, while Soto's really good, one injury, and he misses a bunch of time, and then all of a sudden you've got him for a year and a half, say, because he misses half of a year, and then he's gone, and you've given up your top four or five prospects, and now you've set yourself back 5 or 6 years. So, you know, no, the Cardinals, I wouldn't do it if I was the Cardinals. Like I said, somebody probably will. Would it be the Dodgers? I don't know that the Dodgers would even do that. That's not the team that it makes the most sense, and it sounds like a move that they would make would be the Yankees. You know, I don't know that the Yankees have the prospects to do it. But, you know, that would be the team that if they're going to go all in and just throw a bunch of something at a guy, it would be the Yankees for that name recognition. And, you know, in that bandbox that they play, and Soto might hit 80 home runs in a season. The Mets could be a team, you know, that – although, again, you know, they've got the money to pay him, but do they have the prospects to throw at the Nationals? You know, so that's what you got to look at is who are the teams that are the deepest, their farm systems are the deepest, that they can give up 5 or 6 prospects, their top prospects, and still be okay. Because the Cardinals, while the Cardinals have a pretty decent farm system right now and things are going, you know, if you give up 4 or 5 of those guys, then, you know, again, what are you looking at? Because, you know, you have Soto now, but then in a couple of years, if he's gone, then you look around and you go, okay, wait a minute. Now Goldie's 37 and he's about to be gone. Nolan all of a sudden is 34. And all these kids, we don't have these kids anymore. So then all you guys want Soto and some aging veterans. And, you know, that doesn't work out well either. And then Soto and Boras are going to say, hey, we don't want to be here. We're going somewhere else. So, you know, it's very possible that he doesn't get traded because nobody's able to meet that asking price. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, looking at the top couple of farm systems based off of MLB.com's rankings, you know, you've got the Orioles up at the top spot. They've got, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guys in the top 100 prospects, a catching prospect, a pitching prospect, shortstop, third baseman, an outfielder, and a left-handed pitching prospect. So, once again, that's a team that has probably the collection of guys that, you know, Washington would want, but do they have more past that would allow them to make that trade? And does, you know, would Baltimore be a team that he would even go to? You got Seattle sitting there at number 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They've got 6 in the top 100. Once again, this is another one of those teams that maybe sounds like they have the prospects, but do they have the prospects to bring in a guy like Juan Soto? You got the Rays at three. They're never going to make a big move like that. The Diamondbacks at four won't make a move like that. The Dodgers are sitting at five. They're the fifth best ranked farm system in Major League Baseball. One, two, three, four, five guys in the top 100 prospects. So that, once again, to your point, that might be a team that looks at it. They have the money, obviously. They've got prospects to trade, and they haven't been shy about trading away prospects for the here and now. But at some point, they have to sit there and say, okay, we have to look at the future. We can't continue to do what the Yankees did, essentially, in the 90s. The Yankees were lucky in the sense that they had a very solid core of guys that allowed them to trade off all of their prospects. But then when those guys, to your point, got older, they had nothing to fill the void for a while. And, you know, the Dodgers are getting themselves into a point where they might be like that in the next couple of years, where they don't even really have a core, essentially, that they could keep together. And, you know, yeah, they got Trey Turner now and they've got Gavin Lux, but, you know, Kershaw's getting older, maybe on his last leg. Yeah, Walker Buehler is an up and coming, you know, stud at the pitching spot, but they don't have that core group of about five or six guys that the Yankees had that allowed them to have sustained success. So do they continue to make the moves where they trade off their prospects to try and just stay in the win now moment?
Well, you talk about the Dodgers. The thing that they got to look at, too, is you have to pay those guys. Walker Buehler is going to be a $300 million guy. You're already paying Mookie a ton of money. Cody Bellinger is going to come up. Trey Turner's up this year. Are they going to pay Trey Turner the $300 million that he's going to want? You know, you talk about Gavin Lux. He's got a couple of years. He's going to be a free agent. You know, so they've got a ton of money. They've got to figure out what they're doing there, too. So, you know, I don't know. You know, and then those other teams, you talked about Baltimore. Yeah, they've got the prospects. But if they trade all the prospects, then they have Juan Soto with nothing else. And they're right back where they were, except they've got a guy they're paying a bunch of money who's hitting a lot of home runs, but they're not winning anything. You know, Seattle might be possible because they've got some young players that are already up here.
True.
That are very good. And then you make that move. Maybe Seattle would be a place, although I don't know that Soto would want to go out there, because I don't know if Boris would do that, because there's just not a whole lot of media attention for the Mariners. Although maybe if Soto went out there, that would change a little bit. Maybe you could pitch him that he could be like the next King Griffey out there or something like along those lines, or an A-Rod when he was out there. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out, because if the Nationals are able to make that trade, they're going to set themselves back up to be really good again really fast. But think of how good the Nationals were a couple of years ago. Yeah. And all those guys that are Bryce Harper and Rendon and, you know, Trey Turner. And, you know, now you're talking about Soto being gone and Strasburg and, you know, all those guys, and they're all gone now. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how Soto plays out. It'll definitely be interesting to watch as we get closer to the trade deadline to see if something happens.
It is interesting to look at that too, in the free agency period too. I mean, will you ever have another team like the New York Yankees with six, seven guys that stick with a team for almost an entire career, sustain success, multiple championships they went up against the luxury tax. They had to pay fines and penalties and all that stuff because those guys did started to get higher contracts. But the amount of turnover and the shortness of a fuse when it comes to allowing a guy to get through stuff, it's there now. And, you know, you look at the Dodgers are definitely a good parallel to the Yankees at that time frame, because they spend a ton of money. They bring in premium guys at premium positions all the time, but they also continue to cycle guys out as well, so that, you know, you may be there 3 or 4 years, but then the next hot thing comes along at your position and the Dodgers are, we're going to move on. We're going to bring this guy in and all that kind of stuff. The Cardinals are kind of like the Yankees in a sense, where they do have guys at, you know, long-term at specific positions. They don't have a whole lot of turnover, but the sustained success that the Yankees had, the Cardinals have success, but not at the level that the Yankees did in the 90s and early 2000s. Will we ever see another franchise that can really put that kind of run together with a consistent team?
You know, that's just hard to say because there's so many variables there when it comes down to health and, you know, trade, you know, guys ended up having to be traded because of injuries and injuries themselves. And there's so many different things that go into that, you know, with that working. A team that you could look at and say, okay, here's a young team that's got a core that possibly could do it would be the Padres. You know, when you think about Machado is going to be there for, you know, he's already been there for 3 years, he's going to be there for another 5 or 6 years. You know, you talk about Tatis Jr., you know, by the time Eric Hosmer's deal's up, he's going to have been there for 7 years if they hang on to him. A Will Meyer. So those guys, you know, that's a team that still could potentially do that because those guys are still young. And, you know, if they can ever keep their pitching healthy, you know, they're a team that could, with the potential that they have with all of those guys, they could do that. They could have a 3 or 4 year run where they win a bunch with the same core group of guys. So right now, I think that's the team that you look at and say they have the most potential to possibly do it other than the Dodgers, because they can still do it with the group, like we said, with Bellinger and with Muncy and with those guys that have been there for a while, that they can still win a couple more and kind of have that run.
And I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I think the one thing that differentiates that Yankees franchise, that dynasty, from either of those two teams that you just talked about, those Yankees players were selfless. You know, they were playing in New York. They were making a ton of money. They were winning championships, but it always felt like there was a selflessness about them that I don't see nowadays in a lot of you know, teams and a lot of players. And that could be completely false. I mean, these guys probably had selfishness in them, but they found ways to keep that team intact. Yes, the money continued to rise and grow and all that, but they were also successful, so the money was there. It just felt like for me that team, as much as I hated them, I hated seeing them win every year. I celebrated so much when the Marlins beat them twice. But there was still a bit of a selflessness about them that you may not see nowadays. Because you, like you said, a guy like Soto has already turned down a $350 million contract and wants probably $500 million. Not to say that those guys wouldn't have tried to go after that if they could, but it didn't seem like that was the case. You know, just take Bernie Williams and Mo Rivera, for instance. Those guys made their money, but you never really heard, although times are different, you never really heard about contract holdouts or anything like that. Those guys wanted to play for the Yankees. They wanted to play with each other, and they wanted to win together. I don't have that same feeling, in a sense, with some of these other teams nowadays.
Yeah, and you got to remember that those guys all came up together. You know,
yeah, that too.
Mariano and Posada and Jeter and Williams all kind of came up. They all came up at the same time. And then they came up with some really good veterans. I mean, think about the core guys, the older guys. When those guys first got there, you had Don Mattingly. You had Paul O'Neill. Wade Boggs was on the team when those guys first got there. So you had these really talented guys that had been around for a long time that were leaders and taught them the right way to do things. And then they came up and they kind of followed in that foothold, and, you know, just kind of kept that thing going. And it's kind of what we talk about. People give a lot of backlash to the Cardinal way. You know, the things that Chris Carpenter and Albert Pujols and Jim Edmonds and Scott Rowland had that they passed on to the guys, and how the Cardinals go about their business. That's the way the Yankees were, because those guys were professional, and, you know, they taught Jeter and Mo and Posada and those guys and Bernie, and then they passed it on and they passed it on. And that's just kind of how that goes. And some organizations have that and some don't.
Pedigree.
And that's, you know, and that's why the Cardinals and the Yankees are, and the Dodgers are the three, you know, most respected, most winningest organizations in baseball, because they have that. They have that organizational depth. They have that organizational knowledge. And there's a certain way they do things. And the players come up through that in the minor leagues. And they're taught that from the time they very first put on those uniforms in single A and double A. And, you know, and that's how that works. And a lot of organizations just don't have that.
Yeah. It all comes down to pedigree. I mean, when you have generation upon generation that continue to cycle the same message to the next generation, and that next generation follows it, that shows you've got something there. And like you said, the Yankees, the Cardinals, the Dodgers, they all have that. And once again, that's why they're successful. That's why they're always mentioned in the top franchises in all of sports in general too. So there is that. So, all right. Enough talking about baseball. I love talking about it. would love talking about it more if the Cardinals were one, but we'll set that aside for tomorrow when they go into Pittsburgh and have all the new shiny toys and maybe win a game. But let's jump into our preview for tonight's game between the Blues and the Avalanche. Game two tonight, you know, the 3-2 overtime loss for the Blues in game one doesn't really tell the whole story. We talked about this a little bit last night. You just thoroughly outplayed, outshot, 54 shots on net for the Avalanche. I think it was something in the range of 30-something for the Blues. I was so depressed about that game, I didn't even look at their shot total. But we did take some, and we pulled some positives out of that game as well, and something that we can look for in this game tonight to maybe see if the trend can continue and really turn the tide in this series early on. The Blues special teams did everything that they were supposed to do. They scored on the power play, the one that they had. It was the game-tying goal late in the third period. They did what they needed to do there. They shut down the Colorado Avalanche power play on three power play attempts. So they did what they needed to do there. They kept the big guys in check. Yes, MacKinnon and Landeskog had three assists combined in that game. 13 shots on goal between those two and Cale Makar. So they got opportunities, but they really did do what they needed to do to kind of limit the chances for those guys. And that's something that they've done against Colorado all season as well. I mean, the leading scorer for the Avalanche against the Blues was JT Compher with 6 points. So when you've got him and Nazem Kadri as your top 2 point producers against you, and you keep the likes of MacKinnon and Landeskog and Makar and those guys off the score sheet, or at least limited on the score sheet, you have a better chance of winning. And the Blues did that in game one. They're hopefully going to be able to do that in game two. The one thing that they have to do, though, this was something that was evident in the Minnesota Wild series and something that was wildly evident in game one. Faceoffs, faceoffs, faceoffs. The Blues lost the faceoff battle 64-36%. That is horrific. At one point, I think Ryan O'Reilly was the only player at 50% faceoff percentage in that game. Everybody else was 20% or lower. That's just not going to get the job done, especially in a game where you're playing at high altitude. You have to have short changes. You're playing with one less forward because of the 11 forward 7D setup. It was just the perfect storm for not producing a very good game. And the fact that the Blues came away with just an overtime loss, they should be counting their blessings that is the case, and something that they're going to have to really improve on tonight.
Yeah, they really are. You know, they just need a better game all the way around from their offense, from their forwards. They need to win faceoffs, like you said. They just have to play better on the offensive end of the ice. You know, they just didn't show up in a lot of ways on Tuesday night. They've got to play better that way. You know, your defense has to show up. You know, you can't have Jordan Bennington facing 50 shots again tonight. You know, they just got to all around play a better game. And you would hope after Craig Berube kind of came out in the last couple of days and really tore into him, you would expect them to come out with a lot of fire tonight and really want to prove a point. Plus, I mean, you know, just for themselves, they have to know that if they go down 2-0, they're in trouble, even though they're coming back to St. Louis. It's going to be hard to bounce back if you go down 0-2. So, you know, they really need to go out. They need to be self-fired up, self-motivated. But then, like I said, the fact that their coach really came out and really tore into them and really talked about how they didn't play as a team and they were playing for themselves and all of those things that they didn't do and they weren't on the same page. You would think they'll come out and be of one mindset tonight and really play team hockey and try to prove a point and try to come back home with that split and really have a shot in the rest of the series.
And the thing going into tonight is Coach Berube made a bunch of lineup changes. He put his money where his mouth was, essentially. It was like, hey, you weren't playing as a team. Well, because you're not playing as a team, we're going to change everything up. You're going to get out of your comfort zone. You're going to play with guys you haven't played with in a long time because we need to change things up. And it's all up and down the forward lineup. You know, Buchnevich moves up to play with O'Reilly and Perron. Buchnevich hasn't had a goal in this postseason. Saad, Thomas, and Kyrou are going to get together. Not the most defensively gifted forward group, but one that can really put some pressure on the Avalanche offensively if they can win faceoffs and if they can put some pressure on in the Avalanche offensive zone. Barbashev, Shen, and Tarasenko, that's a veteran lineup. You know, those guys have played well together. They've produced when they've been put together. And then you've got Toropchenko and Bozak on that fourth line, which means once again, they're going with 11 forward and 7 defensemen tonight, which I questioned a little bit because you're playing at altitude. And yes, now you are sitting, and they arrived on Monday. You're sitting at, you know, day four now in Colorado, so maybe you're a little bit more acclimated to the atmosphere and getting out there and know how your body will react to that. But I knew in game one that, you know, you're already double shifting forwards for a good portion of that game. You have to take shorter shifts than you normally would because of that. You're playing at altitude, and then once again, losing the faceoff battle, you're out there for longer than you want to be. You can tell why that Blues team wore down in game one, and once again, lucky that they came away with an overtime loss and not a 9-1 blowout, which it should have been. But did you see enough in practice yesterday to justify going back out there with 11 forwards and 7 defensemen? And if you didn't, could we potentially see one of those defensemen slot into a forward position, which is something I don't think is necessarily out of the question? You know, a guy like Colton Parayko, okay, hear me out on this one. Hear me out. I know he's supposed to be one of our top defensemen. He's going to be out there a lot. But why not every so often throw him out there as a forward on a shift? He's a guy that's led the rush. The game I went to against Minnesota, game four, the first goal of the game was due, in fact, from the point that he rushed up the ice, took that puck into the offensive zone, and drove it hard down deep into the offensive zone. So maybe you throw him out there for a shift or two at forward, really make the Avalanche think, oh no. And it also gives you an extra defender out there as well, an extra defenseman that maybe could help prevent something that happens, because he can get back from the offensive zone quickly. It's not a, you know, perfect situation, but why not every so often, if you're playing with 11 forward, throw one of those defensemen out there at a forward position and see what you can do.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it couldn't hurt. You throw it out there, change things up, see what happens. You never know. Maybe you find lightning in a bottle type of thing, and lightning strikes and something happens, and that's the spark that lights the team up, and you go on a run. Who knows? I mean, things like that sometimes can change a series. So, yeah, maybe take a chance and see if that would work a little bit. Talking about Colton Parayko real quick. Did you by any chance happen to hear the Chris Pronger, Randy Carragher conversation today?
I did not, no.
Chris Pronger pretty much tore into Randy Carragher because there was some conversation about, you know, is Colton Parayko ever, does he need to play more like Chris Pronger? Is he ever going to be a Chris Pronger type? And Pronger basically said, Carragher said, what does Colton Parayko need to do? And Carragher basically said, stop listening to you guys, and you guys need to leave him alone and quit telling him to be somebody he's not. He's never going to be me. And I thought, you know, and Randy was kind of quiet there for a minute. You can tell Pronger was just done with that whole comparison. It was just like, just shut up and leave the kid alone and let him be who he is, you know?
I you know what? I mean, when we've talked about it, you know, we've talked about why can't he be more like Chris Pronger. But Pronger's right. I mean, every player is different. You're not going to have a completely mirror player in this league. No one is, you know, we asked why Vladimir Tarasenko wasn't Alexander Ovechkin. And it's only because they were Russian. That's right. The only reason that we compared the two. So I get it. You know, you look at a guy that's 6'6", 6'7", you go, well, why can't you be Chris Pronger? Well, that's not his style. I mean, we said the same thing about why can't Colton Parayko be Alex Pietrangelo.
Right.
It's just not who they are. And yeah, that's the fault of us in the media. But trying to perpetuate that day in and day out, we have to just kind of be happy with what we got and help him continue to be productive and successful here. He has talent. He has the tools. Maybe it's just a matter of putting him with the right person, or maybe even shifting his role. Going back to the forward defense thing, Brent Burns is a perfect example of a guy that went from defense to forward, ended up going back to defense. Maybe that's a role that Colton Parayko ends up playing, to where he becomes and transitions to a forward for a few years, gets some experience there, and then eventually, as maybe he slows down a little bit, he shifts back to the defensive side of things. That might be a role that he goes. But then again, you're comparing him to Brent Burns here.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it is a matter of letting him be who he is, but it's a matter of critiquing him on what he does, not what he doesn't do, because he's like this other guy.
Well, and that's just the nature of sports. We do that in every sport to every athlete. You know, people, you're going to hear it with Matthew Liberatore. Well, is he the next Adam Wainwright? You know, is Nolan Gorman the next Nolan Arenado? Why isn't this guy, you know, why isn't Dylan Carlson Jim Edmonds? Or why isn't Harris? You know, we do it in every sport with every athlete. It's just the nature of the media and the nature of sports fans to compare guys to the guys that came before them, or the guys that are built the same as them, or the guys that played the same position. It's just a natural comparison, that it happens all the time in sports.
It is. It really is. And I don't think it'll ever go away, no matter how much you try.
No, because it's been going on forever, you know, since since Mickey Mantle came up and people said, is he going to be as good as Joe DiMaggio? You know, I mean, that's just the nature of sports and sports fans.
It certainly is. Now, tonight, you've already gone on record because you said it last night that this is a must-win game for the Blues. They have to come back home tied at one. I mean, I'm starting to come around on that feeling as well. I thought I'd be comfortable with them maybe coming back down 0-2, but I think I am starting to drift back into your territory of this is definitely a must-win game. If the Blues don't win tonight, though, and they do come back home down 0-2, do you possibly see a switch in goal to Ville Husso to shock this team again, or do you roll with Jordan Binnington the rest of the way?
I mean, I think it comes down to, if Binnington plays lights out like he did the other night, how do you pull it? You know, because then you shatter his confidence because he's going to say, okay, I did everything I could do and I still lost the job. So I don't know. If he plays like he did the other night, I don't know how you can do that no matter what happens to him.
I mean, he's 0-6 against the Avalanche in his career in the playoffs, but he has a 3.16 goals against, and the save percentage is .918. That's the second best save percentage in the playoffs in his career. The only save percentage that's better is against the Wild. He's a .923 save percentage against the Wild. So even though he's 0-6 against Colorado, he plays his A game against these guys, and it's the offense that really has kind of let him down, and sometimes the defense as well. So I think you're right. I mean, if he plays well tonight, there's no reason that you make that change. And if they do lose, I really think you have to look at, you know, switching back to the 12-6 forward defenseman thing. I also think you have to look at maybe making some more lineup changes, maybe pulling a guy that has not produced in the playoffs and really taking a look at this team and going, look, you haven't done it. Yes, you are a name player. But you got to sit. We got to make a move or send him down to the fourth line or what have you. I think that's something that Coach Berube has to look at. Although I am confident, based on all the changes that he's made in this for this team over the years that he's been here, I feel like what he's done tonight has given this team the fire and the desire and the chance to win this game tonight. I feel comfortable going out and saying I think the Blues win tonight.
I'm not comfortable. I hope they win tonight. I think they can win tonight. But, you know, again, you're playing a really, really good Colorado team. And you're playing in Colorado, in that thin air. That just makes it that much more difficult. I feel like the Blues have a good chance to win tonight. I'm not going to say I'm confident, though.
Okay. I respect that 100%. I just want to be confident. That's all.
I know.
Oh, boy. So that game will get underway here in about an hour or so. It's going to be over on TNT, but I would suggest listening to it on 101 ESPN. If you can, listen in to Kerbs and Vitaly give the call. Alex Ferrario on the pregame and intermission reports as well. So make sure that I'm pretty sure the pregame's going on right now over there on 101 ESPN. So once we wrap up here, you can switch over there and check that out. Let's talk quickly about the NBA. We talked about this the other night about the fact that Al Horford and Marcus Smart were questionable for tonight's game against the Miami Heat. It looks like actually both of those guys are going to play tonight. So that's a huge amount of news for the Boston Celtics going into game two tonight after they fall in game one. They desperately need Al Horford back in this lineup. And I think you're going to see a different game tonight between Boston and Miami than we saw in game one. And that should make Celtics fans very, very excited. Because, you know, Miami kind of ran away with that one. Yes, it was a little bit closer score-wise, but I think Jimmy Butler and that Heat team just kind of ran away in that game one and gave themselves a lot of confidence going into tonight's game.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's big news for Boston if those guys are close to being 100%. If they're 50% or 40% and they're just out there playing, then it's not that big of a deal. But if they're close to being back to normal, then, yeah, that's huge for Boston. And both of those series are going to be really interesting because Golden State kind of destroyed Dallas last night.
Yeah.
You know, and Luka didn't play a great game. You know, I mean, he was okay, but he wasn't his A game last night. But, you know, he's going to have to get a lot of help from the rest of that Dallas lineup because Golden State appears to be on a mission to get back to the finals.
And I think they would probably rather play Miami in the finals than they would rather play Boston. Although the NBA probably wants to see Boston and Golden State in the finals as well. I mean, I think no matter which teams are in the NBA finals, I think you're actually going to have good ratings because I think all those spots, all those teams have great fan bases. And I think a lot of people would be interested to see whoever's in there. I think obviously Boston is Boston, so that's a big name. I think Miami, they're going to pull from not just the Florida area, but they'll pull from Chicago as well. People in Chicago still want to see Jimmy Butler be successful. Dallas is Dallas. You're going to get that. And I think a lot of people know who Luka Doncic is, so they want to see him. And then it's Golden State. You got the big three there and maybe a last ride, last hurrah kind of thing. So I think regardless of who makes the finals, I think the NBA is going to be happy with who gets there.
Yeah, and you know, and if you get a Miami-Dallas, that's a rematch of a few years ago when LeBron was there. And Dirk, I mean, different players because you had LeBron and Dirk leading those teams, but you still have that matchup. And then, like you said, anytime you get the Celtics, I mean, the history of the Boston Celtics as much as anything else. And then, like you said, the big three with Steph and Clay and Draymond. So, yeah, I think the TV ratings are going to be good. I think you'll have people excited about that, however it turns out. And just hope we get better games because, like you said, game one in both conferences was not – did not live up to expectations.
No, and as long as you don't get game seven of that Phoenix-Dallas series ever again, I think the NBA will be happy.
Like we said last night, that was probably the worst game seven in any sport ever.
You know what? I haven't looked out to see if there are any lists, but it probably does top that for sure. For sure. All right. Well, Scott, you got anything else before we head out tonight and go catch a hopeful St. Louis Blues victory?
Real quick, if people haven't been paying attention, and there's not been a formal announcement yet, but for XFL fans, it looks like the Dome has secured dates for next spring, 5 or 6 dates for potential home games for the Battlehawks. So it looks like it's getting at least potentially closer that that announcement could come sometime in the near future that the Battlehawks are back and will be playing in the Dome next spring.
That is good news for Battlehawks fans and Kakaw Nation and all of that. That would be great. I mean, we hope to have that official announcement here very, very soon. I know that things have been coming out slowly. I know the XFL has partnered with ESPN as well for broadcasting rights, so they'll be on the flagship station of the NFL sort of thing for the XFL, so you're going to be put on national TV there. But still, once again, I mean, it has been odd how they've announced these things. You know, they've announced the coaches, but they haven't announced who they're, you know, where they're coaching. You've got the broadcasting rights have now been announced as well and everything along those lines. But the fact that cities haven't been announced yet, it's a very, very odd announcement schedule that the XFL has been doing. But maybe that's by design. You know, maybe it's one of those things that it will keep people talking across the country versus just in the cities that they are going to be in. And maybe that is something that they want to do, is keep the XFL on the people, on the tips of people's tongues until the last possible minute. And then you announce the cities.
Yeah. And you know, there were some rumors yesterday that teams were going to be rebranded and they're going to be new name, team names and colors. And, you know, some cities were still going to be in and there were going to be some different cities. And, you know, there's still a lot of up in the air stuff. You know, the rumors yesterday were that all the other teams were going to get rebranded except the Battlehawks. You know, again, no confirmation of that, but that was the rumor yesterday. So, you know, and little bits and pieces, like you said, come out every couple of weeks, it seems like. But, yeah, it seems funny at this point, as much as The Rock has kind of pushed it, that we haven't gotten the cities and how that's going to work. But, you know, he does like to build things up, and he'll probably, like, announce it at some movie premiere or something.
Probably. You know?
When Black Adam comes out, that's when you finally find out who they are. He'll tie it all in together somehow.
It'll be in the movie. Like, they'll visit each stadium in the movie, and then that's how it'll be announced. But, yeah, that could be it. Now, back to your point about the team rebranding, I think the Battlehawks really were one of the only teams that had a very unique name and logo. If you looked at everybody, at all the other teams that were in that XFL, it looked like they pulled the logos from Madden and the team names from Madden. So,
right.
I would not be opposed to new names and new logos for those teams, but I do like the fact that the Battlehawks were very unique, a very unique logo, a unique name, and just at the color scheme, while basic, was very unique as well, and I enjoyed that too.
Yeah, and you know, Battlehawk would work. You know, Black Adam fights Battlehawk in the sequel to the, you know, in the Dome, you know.
Hey, you know, hey, Rock, if you haven't thought about this, give us a call. We got some ideas for you.
Yep, we can make it work, man.
All right, man. Well, Scott, enjoy the game tonight and enjoy the games this weekend against Pittsburgh. I will be working my butt off as we got a couple of concerts this weekend down at Hollywood Casino Amphitheater that will be providing for Saturday's Point Fest. So that's an all-day affair. And if you guys are going out to Point Fest on Saturday, make sure you try and swing by and say hi. I'll be on the premises here and there, traveling between the store and the amphitheater. So maybe you can stop by, say hi, and you know, kind of meet some of the faces from Toasted Tavern.
There you go. Swing by, say hi to Wags, and then run over to the Point and say hi and bye to Lux, as that's her last big hurrah at the Point, which it will be weird not to see her and hear her voice on the Point every day.
Although I got a feeling that she has something locally in the works. I mean, with her being a part of St. Louis City FC, the fan experience piece, I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, in the coming weeks we hear some sort of announcement that she is something a part of St. Louis City SC, a big part of that. So she does have something in the works that we know of, and hopefully, and it sounds like it is local, which is really, really good to be able to keep her as part of the local scene. But we do want to send our congratulations to Lux over there, and a heartfelt thank you for all the years that you've put out there in St. Louis radio over there on the Points. We have been very, very fortunate to have an amazing set of, you know, broadcasters in the radio industry here in St. Louis, whether it's at the Point or KSHE or the country stations or KMOX. We're incredibly lucky. Charlie Brennan just retired as well. So another big name that was a big part of St. Louis radio. And we've just been incredibly lucky to have such talent here in St. Louis for long extended periods of time.
Absolutely. Well said. And yeah, Charlie Brennan, you know, kind of a staple in St. Louis morning talk. So yeah, a lot of people, and Lux, it's crazy to think 15 years she spent at the Point. And like I said, it'll be weird to turn on the Point every day and not hear her. But like you said, we wish her well in her next journey, and hopefully we'll hear and see exactly what she's doing very soon.
Very, very true. All right. Well, guys, enjoy the Blues game tonight. Enjoy the Cardinals games this weekend. Hopefully you'll be able to enjoy the Blues game on Saturday, too, when they're here to face Colorado for game 3. We'll be back with you guys maybe next week. We've got a lot of things in the works. I know Scott's going to be busy down at Busch Stadium with a 9 or 10 game homestand getting ready to approach here for the Cardinals. But we'll be back with you guys very, very soon to recap everything in the world of sports, especially here in the Midwest. For Scott, I am Wags. Have a great night. We'll see you guys here in the near future.
Hey, it's you, man, here from KSHE. For all your sports news, catch the Toasted Tavern with Scott Tobin and the man called Wags weeknights at 9 p.m. You can follow Toasted Tavern on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Let's get toasted.